Up next on the Baikai Podcast, a presentation by Merlin Mann titled, This is About Much More Than Tools and Rules. Welcome to Baikai, the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of ACM SIGCHI. I'm Steve Williams, and you're listening to the Baikai program for March 14th, 2006, featuring Mimi Yin of the Open Source Application Foundation with a presentation titled Getting Things Done, Technology and Practice, followed by Merlin Mann of 43 Folders, whose presentation is called This is About Much More Than Tools and Rules. This program is available in two parts. This is part two, Merlin Mann's presentation. Part one, Mimi Yin's presentation, is available as a separate recording. Merlin Mann is a strong advocate of the life management methodology called Getting Things Done. He explains that getting things done provides tools to manage the information and messages that bombard us daily, make progress on the projects that are important to us, and escape the feelings of dread and low self-esteem that come from an ever-growing email inbox. Merlin is the creator and editor of 43 Folders, which he describes as a community of expertise, and Fives.com, an entertaining but ultimately pointless collection of lists of five things. If you write about this program on your blog, please consider using the tag Baikai and use the trackback URL, baikai.org/trackback/1168, to add your feedback to the Baikai page. You'll find more Baikai programs, all produced by our generous volunteers, at baikai.org, where you can download audio and video or subscribe to our podcast feed. Links, slides, and notes for tonight's program are available at baikai.org/calendar/2006-0314. Now, here's Baikai's Paul Sass to introduce Merlin Mann.
Our next speaker is Merlin Mann. As a way of introduction, can I ask how many people have read his blog, 43 Folders? Okay. As somebody who was tagged when he was working at Adaptive Path as a person who exposed too much mental sausage, I think there's a lot of people who like Merlin Mann's wieners. You know, they're just really a lot of fun to see him talk about the mental sausage that he's continually generating. I found 43 Folders really fun. 43 Folders is, you know, started as a blog and a community to share the enthusiasm around getting things done. It's grown into like having a hard little cuticle of a podcast, which has really got interesting, incisive little things. I think one of them recently was go on a media diet. And, you know, there's really suggestive, significantly thought-provoking kinds of things. And they're always told in a funny way. So I was really excited that Merlin was going to come. And, you know, the dialogue between Mimi and the Chandler system and Merlin is something that I don't want to stand in the way of, so.
Oh, thank you very much.
So hi, and thank you so much for having me here tonight. Thank you in particular to Paul for setting this up. I'm Merlin, and I do a site called 43 Folders, which you've just heard a little bit about. It's a site about productivity and time management and the class of existential heuristics that have come to be called life hacks, felicitously or otherwise, and it's really just kind of a big running dialogue with myself. The site makes a lot more sense once you understand it as a running pep talk, a constant chuck on the shoulder to keep me in line, because I'm a mess. Well, Mimi told that anecdote about the Netflix, and that is a great getting things done hack, which is, you know, don't put a post-it note on something if you can just put the thing in your way. You know, Danny O'Brien and I, amongst ourselves, like to call these useful landmines, putting things in your way where there's no way that you can ever possibly miss them, and they'll always pop up at the time that you need them. Having said that, I was in the midst of trying to write my godforsaken book for O'Reilly that blew apart in my face, and I was having this very intense conversation with Danny on my cell phone as I'm walking along being very productive, and I'm multitasking, and I've got my Netflix that I need to return, and ironically enough, a copy of the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, the godfather of life hacks. And I'm having this very intense conversation. I'll never forget this. And I walk up to the mailbox and I drop my Netflix in. Only I didn't drop my Netflix in. I actually dropped the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin into the mailbox, which is particularly good if you're a history buff and you know that he invented the postal system. So There's some nice irony there, and that's what you can expect out of the most theoretically productive person in California. I wanted to say thank you so much just in general for having me tonight. It's really a thrill for me to be here in general. I've followed what you guys do in as much as I can understand it, and you all seem really smart. I'm kind of freaked out to be at Park because I was very hastily trying to put together this crummy slideshow last night, and I realized that I wouldn't have anything to do, let alone a job, if it weren't for Park. I would be sitting around doodling on a pad if it weren't for like things that came out of Park. So I'm duly intimidated, if that helps at all. I think I'm not going to go into an exquisite amount of detail about all the minutiae of getting things done. I'll do the typical speaker trick and just ask, how many of you have read the book Getting Things Done? How many of you are just sick to death of hearing about it and don't ever want to hear it again? Fair enough. How many of you have tried or succeeded or in some fashion tried to kind of do getting things done? Wow, okay. Jeez, okay, this will be easy. We'll fly through this. So I will try to make this sufficiently boring for the people who already know about getting things done and incredibly unsatisfying for the people who don't. I want to start by talking a little bit about how I got here, how getting things done found a place in my life. As Paul said, I used to do some, this is, gosh, probably fall or winter of 2003. I have some friends that work at Adaptive Path, and I do various different kinds of, work, and one of the things I do is project management. And they were having this tremendous growth. I mean, as you know right now, they're all this big famous organization, but even then they were growing. They're still in their little tiny office over in the Hobart building, and they were so desperate that they brought me in to help them with their project management, which I'm sure in retrospect was just a terrible decision on their part. But I came in to do project management with them, and I'd been managing projects in one way or another for, 5 or 8 years, and I thought I knew what I was doing. But I was so screwed. I came in there, and before I knew it, I was managing at 1.3 and eventually 5 projects. And if you've ever done project management, the idea of managing 5 projects is, it's like, you remember Live Aid and Phil Collins is flying between London and Philadelphia, except you're doing that on 3 continents and it's all the same day. That's how it felt. So it started out because I was basically losing my mind. I had never been so overwhelmed with email and calendars and changes and just all of this stuff all the time that I was constantly having to process. And then the events would change and it was like calculus and I was having to figure how these people in these different areas, and I'm constantly, Eastern time. And I'm, completely like losing it, And the day came, and I'll never forget this. I suddenly realized that I was going to die behind. It was such a horrible feeling. It's like, it's bad enough to wake up every day and go, it's going to be really hard to get everything done. But I realized that like the deficit that I had created, the debt that I was incurring on a daily basis, it's like the big wheel spinning, and I just realized that like I have a net. Like a net productivity, I have like a -5 productivity. And so tomorrow that's gonna be either -10 or -25, I'm not sure. But it compounds and it goes on and on. And I just thought, this is gonna suck. There's no way I can possibly keep up with this. And I eventually at a certain point felt like I was in a batting cage with all the ball machines pointed at my head. And that the only thing that I could really do was try not to get my nose broken, and that would be a good day. So I had a friend, actually a couple different friends, I can't remember who I should actually credit this to, but a couple friends had said, you're a basket case, as all of your friends know, and you should really check out this book, Getting Things Done, by this, white guy in a suit, wrote this really cool book you should check out. And they're like, oh, whatever, I read a bunch of those books when they were really hot in the 80s, and they just always made me sad. They're just these desperate books by men in suits standing around the Ramada Inn telling you how you can succeed. And it's like, I've seen that. My mom sold real estate when I was a kid, so I was surrounded by books by people like Zig Ziglar, and just all this awful stuff that I call it the philosophy of the capital letter noun, because they seem so obsessed with mission statements and goals and values, and I'm like, well, forget about mission statements. I got 7,000 emails. I don't have time to write a mission statement. I'm losing it. So I read this book. I devoured this book. I really, really liked it, and it really, really connected with me, like, from the day I started picking it up. As these books go, it's relatively jargon-free, give or take. The thing I love most about it is it's completely tactical. You know, all these big books by all these big famous white guys are all about all of these kind of notional things, like in an ideal world, the sky will open and I'll be able to have my way with things. And it's like, you know, I don't know anybody who's in a position like that. You know, the people I know who are really successful still have to answer to VCs. You know, everybody's got somebody they've got to answer to, and they're very seldom in a position to completely realign their world. What they have to do is keep their head above water, and that's what GTD does. Are you guys sufficiently familiar enough with GTD, or should I do like a 45-second super quick explanation of getting things done? Okay, super quick explanation. Don't time me. Getting things done is a system that I'm going to skip ahead just a little bit to get to kind of my little personal definition. When I'm describing GTD to people who don't know what it is, pretend you don't know what it is, I describe it as a framework for making progress on the projects that are important to you. And I, for once in my life, actually chose those words pretty carefully because I think it adequately describes what makes getting things done different from other programs. Getting things done begins with what's called a mental sweep, and this idea that you take every possible thing that's on your mind and in your world and anything that is what David Allen calls stuff. Stuff is anything that hasn't found a place in your life, and yet it continues to burn CPU cycles in your brain, right? As long as something's on your mind, it's not getting done, right? If it were done, I mean, do you think about stuff you finished 2 years ago? No. As long as that stuff's in there, it's gonna drive you nuts. So the idea is you get this all out of your head. You get it into some kind of a place where you can decide what you're gonna do with it, if anything. You put it into what he calls a trusted system, which is basically, it can be digital, it can be paper, what have you. And it becomes a way for you to basically, I'm cutting this real short, but the basic idea is that you become, first of all, become aware of all of the things that are on your radar screen. That you break these out into discrete projects. And a project, in David Allen's definition, is just any desirable outcome that consists of two or more physical actions, right? So you wouldn't call the big Henderson account a project. You'd call plan dinner with Paul a project. It's actually just a series of discrete physical actions. And so the idea is then to actually do these things, you then kind of capture all these things and store them in a system contextually. So you say, these are the kinds of things that I can do on the computer. These are the kinds of things that require a phone. These are the kinds of things that require email. And everybody's context, as these are called, differ, but it becomes a way of having your own little personal autonomy to decide when and where you can do the stuff in your life, what kind of tools you need, what kind of access you need. It's a very powerful way to organize stuff. So instead of just always going, everything's a number one today, you go like, okay, well, here's the stuff that I can do while I'm sitting in the doctor's office. And once you kind of develop your own little kind of mental model for this, it can be very powerful. Projects. Oh, one of my favorite things in getting things done very quickly, this whole idea of what David Allen calls the next action. If you take nothing away from getting things done, at least take away the idea of the next action, because you can put this in use tomorrow. Danny and I used to have this idea that when the book blew up, we were going to create this fake motivational speaker named Alan Davis. And Alan Davis's whole thing was going to be, punch yourself. You've got to get motivated. Punch yourself. It never panned out, but I still think we're leaving money on the table with that. The next action is just this idea that, first of all, David Allen says that when you think about the things you need to do, de-stuffify them. Take them out of the world of nebulous crap and turn them into physical activities. So as much as possible, when there are things that you need to do, as much as possible, turn them into actual physical actions. My addendum to that is try to turn them into physical actions that can be accomplished in a sitting. And for me, a sitting is 10 or 20 minutes. Everything on my to-do list can generally be accomplished in about 8 minutes. And if it gets so molecular that my head's going completely up my butt, I will sometimes make them a little longer. But having said that, there's something very powerful about this idea of the next action, which basically means, what is the next action? It's the next physical activity that I can undertake at a given time that will keep my project moving forward. And this is incredibly empowering. If you have any issues with procrastination, I know I'm sure I'm the only one who has this problem, but if you have any problems with procrastination, there's something very powerful about this idea of the next action. Because you're taking this big ball, if you like to think of it like a big rock, and breaking it into little pebbles. And the thing that Mimi was talking about that's so powerful is what David Allen calls the natural planning model, which is this idea that, you know, you're so used to, I mean, I don't know how much you guys have done dealing with project managers, but when I started, it was all about the Gantt chart, right? And you just couldn't do anything until you opened up Microsoft Project and planned out the next 22 months of your life. And I don't know what kind of cloud these people were living on, but I've never had a Gantt chart make any sense beyond the point when someone hits save. It's already dead to me. It's like the big specs we used to put together for our applications. You know, this is, it's old stuff. the natural planning model just suggests, okay, we've got this goal in mind of what we want to do. We know what the objective looks like. And so now what are the little steps we need to take? We're not going to plan out 15 steps ahead. I'm only ever going to plan out the next thing I need to do. Annie Lamott has a great quote. I don't remember who originally said this, but in Bird by Bird, she talks about the idea of faith is basically like the headlights that God has given us to see the road 10 feet in front of us. And even though we can only see 10 feet in front of us, it still enables us to drive anywhere we want in the world, because that's the only 10 feet we really need to worry about at any given time. And I think that's close enough to the idea of the next action. Powerful stuff. So just to do a little bit of my trademark hand-waving, what do I mean when I talk about this framework for making progress on the projects that are important to you? These are pillars of getting things done that I've tried to distill into this statement. First of all, why a framework? Well, you know, it's not just a bunch of rules that you've got to follow, right? A framework in computer programming might be something like Rails or Perl. It's this idea that there's this collection of great ideas that you can combine in ways that work for you. Right? Think about design patterns. Think about best practices. Right? So instead of thinking about this as some kind of recipe book that you have to follow perfectly or your souffle is going to fall, think of it as a bunch of really great ideas that tend to work well together. Think about it like the Eightfold Path. You know, think about it like the five precepts. The more of these that you do, the better off things are going to be and the less suffering you're going to create in the world. What do I mean when I talk about progress? This is a program that is all about action. This is not about ruminating, it's not about staring, it's not about wondering what's going to happen. It's about taking all the stuff in your world that's important to you and turning it into physical activities. This is really powerful stuff once you put it in place. And then the part that I think gets lost in the lights sometimes, but is really worth calling out, this is the stuff that's important to you, right? So maybe one of the biggest problems that you've got right now is you just keep accepting stupid projects. And how often is your procrastination caused by the fact that you simply couldn't care less about a single thing on your list? So think about it. So the way I read this is David Allen is saying, get out there and build yourself a frickin' firewall between you and the world. And you're the only person who gets to punch holes in that wall. You decide whose ports get to come in through there, so to speak. And I think this is, like I say, it's arguably one of the most overlooked parts of getting things done. And I think it's arguably one of the most powerful. Because ultimately, you know, you start talking about these levels and the different kind of view levels. The 20,000 foot view is not even going to be in sight until you can clear away all this cruft you've got in front of you. There's something very empowering about going through your to-do list and realizing how much of it is either A, completely undoable, or B, totally stupid. And when you take that off and start focusing on the stuff that's really valuable to you, and you start saying, you know what, I'm going to really value my time, and I'm not going to get pushed around by a bunch of stupid BS on my list, you suddenly get a lot more productive. Because you're not just sitting there churning over these same 15 items for six months. And so that's how I came up with this particular definition. As ever, I am not a sanctioned David Koh employee. I do not work for David Allen. I am simply the humble John the Baptist to his big guy. And I'm just happy to share as I can. Well, of course, I'm still friends. I still drink with Jeff Veen, but I lack the gene for being particularly great at project management. So I've entered into a career of hand waving, which is how I came to do 43 folders. 43 Folders is a site that I do. It started in September of 2004. It really started mostly just as a place for me to park ideas that I was kind of excited about. Those ideas tend to be productivity and getting things done. Getting things done is not the only thing on the site, any more than CNN is necessarily a channel about missing blonde women. It's something that comes up a lot. It's something that excites me, and so it makes it on there. But again, see also idea of site as conversation with myself. Lots of stuff about OS X, not so much stuff about Windows. For that, I shan't apologize. There's a lot of focus on kind of small, incremental, non-invasive ways that you can choose to make your life just a little bit better without actually becoming a hippie. It's a site that really caught on with the geeks, which was really cool. There's a lot about getting things done that really connects with the geeks. And the geeks, writ small, I would have defined as sysadmins, programmers, developers. In a slightly larger circle, we're talking about designers, writers. And then there's this really increasing, the really big circle at this point, is you see all these people who move like even from like the totally straight corporate world to working at home part-time. And the site filled a need. And the question is, what is the need that filled? The need is crazy modern life. Your life is insane, and I'm the only one who's willing to tell you so. Your boss is not going to find it acceptable when you say it's crazy that I've got 5,000 emails in my inbox. I'm here to say you are officially no longer obligated to feel guilty about how stupid all of your email is. You can feel free to go forward and sin no more. A lot has changed very, very quickly. I did a podcast a few weeks ago. It was full of the F-bomb. Boy, a lot of people complained about that. I'm not doing it tonight because it's Park, you know. It was called The Richard Scarry Book of the Future, and it was my ruminations on the idea. Do you remember the Richard Scarry books when you were kids, like Busy Busy World, these awesome little books with like little, you know, rabbits, rabbit firemen and little foxes riding bikes? And I've actually had this conversation over drinks with friends, like what is the Richard Scarry Book of the Future going to look like? It's like it's going to be 80 beautifully illustrated pages of a cartoon mouse sitting at a desk with headphones on. Because virtually everyone I know, if you looked at them, they don't have a red fireman's hat, they're typing. People ask me what I do for a living, I say I type. I type and I have coffee. Sometimes I print, I get more coffee. But the fact of the matter is, our jobs, our careers, the things that we get paid for have changed tremendously in the last 25 years. I would pull this one out of my butt. I would say that most of the jobs that my friends have today either didn't exist 25 years ago or existed in such a completely different format that they wouldn't even recognize it today. With the possible exception of, I don't know, plumbers. I mean, I don't know. Plumbers probably are more wired than ever. I mean, even doctors. Look at the way the technology has affected all of these things. But even if you didn't have a huge change in technology in your field, just the blunt amount of stuff that people have to deal with today, it's completely overwhelming. You know, I'm going to give you a very specific instance in a minute of this, but think about right now. Think about how your life has changed in the last 10 years. I mean, a lot of you, you know, probably come from fields like, probably library science and psychology. I mean, just think about people who work in libraries. I mean, it's absolutely, I mean, I graduated from college in 1990. And we were still, had the scholarship, not the scholarship, the where you got to work deal. And we still had the little white cards, you know? That was 1990. It's absolutely amazing to me how much so many things have changed and completely realigned. But the bottom line is we're all overwhelmed. I finally got rid of Netflix. I've cut way back on the TiVo. I recently deleted 220 RSS feeds out of my reader. I've dialed it way, way down. I've never looked back. And you know what? I am not missing a thing. That's a sidebar. The biggest change, and this is just, again, this is just my, 2020, but the amount of self-management that all careers seem to require at this point, there's an extraordinary amount of self-management and self-management skills that you need to succeed today. More and more jobs are a black box, where orders and demands go in one side, and perfectly timed deliverables are excreted out the other end. Nobody really cares what happens in the black box. That's why they hire you. They don't want to know what happens inside the black box. I don't want to know about throwing exceptions. I don't want to hear about affordances. I don't know boxes. I don't know arrows. I don't care about your chi or whatever it's called. All I care about is I need my stuff. I need this thing to go up, and I need to get my second round. And that's the way the black box works. So what happens inside the black box? Well, you got some poor lummox like me who doesn't know his butt from the hole in the ground, who's got a bunch of dead tools, weird methodologies, and poor training, and is expected to somehow cobble this together into some kind of a modern career, and it's perfectly appalling to me. Geeks have it worse than anybody else, but geeks are just the canary in the coal mine. These are just the folks who have the problems on a scale and a little bit earlier than everyone else, right? Sysadmins, we were talking about this at dinner. Sysadmins understood what happened when you get the output of 1,000 cron jobs a day. You start getting every email goes to root. I mean, you're losing your mind. And now my mom's facing this. Now everybody's wanting to refinance my mom's house, you know? Even when she's got the spam cleared away, she's got all these people sending her kitty photos. So she's got all this tremendous amount of stuff she's got to deal with. She has this new world that she was never prepared to deal with. She's the most popular 71-year-old woman I know, though, because now she fixes other people's computers. And that has made her really popular. So I think this is kind of what's really brought people around to 43 folders is just a need for this stuff. So this has been a good thing. It's been a good thing in the sense that I think we're starting to have a vocabulary about this stuff, right? I mean, it's like I don't know exactly what disease I have, but I know that I can describe the nausea, headache, and what have you. Yes. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, we all have this kind of baseline low hum of dissatisfaction with all the crap in our life and all of these odd demands that are being made on our time. But I don't think a lot of folks have the vocabulary yet to even know how to ask for help. You know, we're not a culture that really encourages people to get out and innovate in a lot of ways. And not to go off on Windows in particular, but I'm not gonna. I'm not that guy. But something I see a lot. I mean, I understand the idea of the installed user base, but you know, I go into people's offices. I'm like, oh yeah, go bring this up in Firefox, and they're like, Firefox, what's that? I can't install things. The guy with the cape and the snake will come in and yell at me. You know, it's Mac users have root privileges. We get to do cool stuff, and I guess the larger point that I struggle to make is that I don't think we really encourage people to go seek out novel ways to improve their lives, especially in the workplace. I think you're expected to show up and be a good German and get there at 8 o'clock and punch out on time and not cause a lot of trouble. And you're not supposed to come in there and shake it up and go, you know what, it's really kind of screwed up that I got like 100 emails today about Sally's birthday at the Bennigan's. You know, does anybody else think this is really stupid and a huge waste of my time? Who do I go to like basically, you know, call out the fact that my day is being completely wasted by all of my colleagues? You people suck. And it's become a forum. People come to 43 folders. People go to all of these plethora of sites that are out there now because they're finding like minds. They're finding people who didn't even realize. It's like they're coming out of some kind of a productivity closet. They didn't even know there was this whole world out there of people who love show tunes and David Allen. And it's a tremendous thing. There's a certain amount of community that's really come up around this stuff. And it's really exciting. It's great for me because I enjoy being the host for it and I enjoy reading it and following along. But it's also really gratifying to see people going through what I went through a couple years ago, which is coming out of the point of feeling like there's something actually just like chemically wrong with me because I think so much of this stuff is really hard. But there's a funny thing, and I will share the funny thing with you. I started the site in September of 2004, and I had two articles that come to mind that I posted in the first week to 10 days of the site's existence. And those two posts, to this day, are the most popular content on the site. So stuff changes from day to day. You know, of course, like all geeks, I'm sitting there reloading stats and collecting my hugs. But I can see this. I mean, posts will get popular for a day or two and fall off. But there's two posts that have always done really well and to this very day do well. So perhaps not surprisingly, the first one is a post called Getting Started with Getting Things Done. The quick way to get to that is gtd.43folders.com. We'll take you there. And I realized when I started the site that I was going to be talking about getting things done a lot. Not to the exclusion of other things, but that it was going to come up a lot. And I wanted to create kind of this sort of geek-centric introduction that would let people see, well, here's why I think this is useful, and here's what David Allen says, and this is why stuff is bad. And so that's still a really popular post. The other post, and I apologize in advance, is introducing the Hipsterpedia. And if you've been fortunate enough to be living under a stone for the last year and a half, you have avoided the ridiculous, overcharged meme-ness of the Hipsterpedia. The Hipsterpedia is quite simply the most modest thing in the world. It's a real thing. It had a life before it was a meme. Hipsterpedia is simply 12 index cards and a binder clip. And that is my information capture device. And it cost about 30 cents. And there's something that's kind of interesting to me that those two, for whatever reason, have kind of stuck around and remained popular with people. The Hipsterpedia, by the way, some assembly is required. That's roughly what you'll need. So what's interesting about this? Not that much, but it's interesting to me that, I look at getting things done as being about framework and rules. I mean, not rules, again, not rules in the sense of like, you've got to do it this way. It's not on big stone tablets or anything. But getting things done represents a certain kind of framework. As I once described it to a friend of mine as, I was actually doing some project management work for a friend and said, if you find that the water of your life keeps spilling onto the floor, maybe you should consider getting a glass. And to me, that glass, in a lot of ways, is project management. And to me, in a sense, that glass in this instance is also getting things done. It's a very simple, relatively clear framework for keeping things together. But it is a framework and it does involve rules. Hipsterpedia represents this kind of low-tech as it is, represents this kind of foray into the world of tools. So what's interesting about this? Well, not much, except to say that geeks like gadgets, tricks, and squirrely systems, which is absolutely true. Funny thing about that is, so if you go and you look at all these sites that are out there now about productivity, how to put your pants on faster, how to print your own graph paper at home, how to choose a hat, there's all these sites out there that are all about all these little, really molecular little tricks that are really fun for a week or two. Two things you'll find, these twin things. You'll find a real interest in tools and technology, and you'll find a tremendous obsession with these frameworks. I mean, my God, go look at Delicious. I guess y'all know Delicious, right? You go, or Dig, or what have you. They're lousy with all of these crazy apps that do all these different things that theoretically make you more productive or help you do various things. But it's interesting to me that whenever we go to look for help for these things, we turn to frameworks and we turn to tools. And I mean, I gotta say, one of the reasons I did the Hipster PDA post, quite honestly, is because I got kind of tired of, at every turn, being reminded that the answers to all of my problems were at Circuit City for $400. I really feel like there's been a push in the last 35 years to start thinking first of what kind of technology we can buy and then how we can apply that in ways that may or may not solve our actual problem. And ditto goes for a lot of these systems. I mean, getting things done is something that's worked for me. But boy, I'll tell you, I had to kiss a lot of frogs before I got to getting things done. There's a lot of frameworks out there that are just real squirrely and require you to kind of give your life over to them. The point being, there is, believe it or not, an elephant in the room. There's the one thing here, the third leg of that stool that we're just not thinking about, and that's behavior. It's such a modest little thing. What about our behavior? What does our behavior comprise? Well, for my purposes, not for you new master's degree types from Stanford, but just play along with me for a minute. I would say that comprises your attitude about things. It's your outlook and how you tend to look at the world and regard the things that are around you. It's the activities that you take part in. What are your actions? It goes into your decision making, you know, and that could be decision making about the kind of tools and frameworks you apply, but it's also just your day-to-day kind of ground level, how you deal with the world kind of thinking process. And it involves what I would call self-aware action, which is just not being kind of mindlessly driven by the engine of whatever your tool is to go out and seek out problems, you know? Nobody goes out and, you know, just buys a divining rod and then goes, gosh, I wonder if we need water, you know? Becoming a little more mindful about the ways that we choose all these things in our lives and the kinds of things that we let in. I once said on my website that it's possible for you to buy a successively more costly and high-tech series of hammers. But until you learn a little bit about woodworking, you're going to continue to make a succession of ugly birdhouses. And nothing is going to make a birdhouse pretty by buying nicer and nicer hammers. At some point, you're going to have to learn how to use them. And there's been a certain amount of disincentive, I think, toward really looking at ourselves and looking at the way that we think and operate. We're always encouraged to just look over there and look at that next piece of technology, or look at this next little framework that's going to save your butt, right? This is just my own thought on this. I think it's time that we start looking at the ways that we can improve our own skills and improve our own attitudes to put the frameworks and the tools to best use. I have a case study. I came up with this about 2:00 this afternoon. It is a case study that I call the miracle of email. Do you guys remember 1995? Show hands, remember 1995? 1995 was awesome. You know, there was still, like, you know, they were still trying to squeeze out Nirvana records in 1995. We had a president. It was, God, what a great time to be alive. I'll tell you what I remember, though. I remember email. Boy, email. Do you guys remember email? Email was awesome. I had, starting in about 1993, a CompuServe account, which I then, of course, like, I was really cool, so I went up to an AOL account. And then, you understand, I went and I got me a shell account. So I had Pine, you know, and VI, so suck it. I was pretty excited. I had email, and oh my God, I was the biggest email evangelist in the world. I was going, you gotta go get the email. The email is gonna, you just don't understand how this is gonna change everything. This is gonna change the paradigm about your paradigms. This is awesome. I'm telling my mom, you understand, you can talk to your friends back in Cincinnati anytime. I had a friend at Oxford. I'm emailing him, he's emailing me back. We're just spending all day doing email. Do you remember the promise of email? Do you remember how exciting email was going to be? Email was going to give us untethered access. We were going to be able to go check our mail and then deal with it and then answer it later, all in our own time. It's going to be awesome. You'll be able to work on your own. I mean, that's going to be sweet. No more meetings. Meetings? We don't need meetings. We've got email. That's going to be awesome. You don't even have to wear pants. You can be at home. Nobody needs pants anymore. That's 1992 thinking. So the big question is, how's your inbox today? How'd that work out? Did that go real good, getting that email? Did you get a lot accomplished? Shave a lot of hours off the day? Find a lot more free time because of email? Lots of extra time? No. In fact, it's been quite the opposite effect in my experience. Everyone I know is completely screwed by email right now. The volume of email that they get has become a second job. This is something I came across on ZDNet not long ago. I don't know if you can read this. This information mapping claims that 80% of those surveyed deem email writing skills are extremely or very important to the effectiveness of doing their jobs. 65% of the respondents spend from 1 to 3 hours per day reading and writing emails, with 40%, quote unquote, wasting 30 minutes to 3 hours reading ineffectively written emails. Well, deep inside of that paragraph is the stat that normal people spend 1 to 3 hours a day doing email. Now, I have watched over a lot of Silicon Valley and San Francisco shoulders. And I can tell you people spend a lot more than 3 hours a day doing email. And God knows, there are people there, like I say, there's people whose water have broken, there's people in Korean missile silos. There are people that need to be doing email and like having constant access all day long, for sure. But there's a lot of people who are just incredibly overwhelmed. I have a friend who works here in the Valley who works for a company that I will allow to remain nameless, but I understand their home office has really good coffee in Redmond. This friend of mine who works in the Valley gets about 200 actionable emails a day. They are mostly internal emails. These are emails from people on his team and people on other teams that he has to react to. And like I say, they are almost all actionable. They require something, starting with a response, all the way up to having to go to a meeting. This is. I heard this, and I was. My mind was boggled. And when I tell the story to people, I get the very reluctant admission that a lot of people get the same amount of email. And like I say, granted, there are some people out there that are doing some tremendously important things with email. But a huge amount of this is just noise. A huge amount of it is just distractions. And a huge amount of it is just creating meta email work. And so you just spend all day long, like you're George Jetson on the treadmill, just dealing with email, moving email, processing email. It's absolutely mind-boggling to me. Once again, technology has paced our ability to deal with it with changes to our own behavior. We got mobile phones now. You know, you got the mobile phones, so you can have your email, you know, when you're out there. Thank God we finally got BlackBerries, because you know. God forbid you have to sit through your kid's damn play without being able to find out if the Finkelstein account went through. It's absolutely unbelievable. Back, returned, we have tethers, meetings, and pants. They've all come back. 1995 was a lie. So what's really changed? It's all still SMTP pop and IMAP, by and large. But what's really changed? Ubiquity, it's a lot more available, sure. You ever heard that old tale they say about this is that was that great example of changing expectations? The idea that adding washers and dryers in the 1950s did actually absolutely nothing to help most housewives, that it actually created the expectation that laundry would just be done more quickly. So how much has email actually improved things? Has it actually, all that ubiquity actually helped us, or has it just raised the expectations on what we need to do? Or is it, as I suspect, a conspiracy by the hated pants lobby? I report, you decide. The bottom line of all of this hand-waving on my part is just my feeling that our behavior tends to lag technology by months or even years. And that unless we make a very concerted effort to refocus and to realign and to think about how we can adjust our behaviors and our attitudes, very importantly, our attitudes. Your attitude about email better be different today than it was in 1995, or you're mega screwed. You cannot treat each email like a little hug. It's not a little kitten. There's no way you're going to get through all that crap if you keep going, well, you know, it's like when my mom first started getting spam. It was farcical. They took the time to write me this email, and apparently there's some pretty promising things they can do with men's genitals, apparently. And I'm like, Mom, no, delete, go. But you know, how far off are you, right? How much of your stuff can you really effectively filter? And how much of it, the really important stuff that you can't miss, do you still have to process by hand, right? And so what has email done in sum? It's added more hay to our pile, right? I want fewer hay and more needles or something. So the question is, are we screwed? And the answer is, well, kind of. Yes, we are. There are some short-term solutions that I will try to help you with quickly. Every sermon comes with a bowl of soup. Hacking through, or as I like to call it, getting Buddhism done. Because I think this really brings in a certain amount of, I'm going to go just slightly orthogonal, as we like to say in the business, and talk a little bit about this whole idea of mindfulness, which is something that just keeps coming up again and again the more time I spend looking at this stuff. Mindfulness just being the idea that you're in the moment and being tethered to nothing but what's in front of you at the time, rather than constantly being drawn away by, I don't know, things like email notifications, anxieties, fears, all the stuff that keeps you so keyed up about needing that BlackBerry in front of you all the time. There's some basic little mindfulness things I think we can all do, like starting tomorrow morning, that could be really helpful. Stay awake. Don't let yourself be drawn around by your nose, you know? If you find yourself suddenly realizing that 4 hours of your day is gone and you're nowhere closer to where you think you needed to be earlier that morning, if you find you're doing that on a regular basis, you're not awake. You're not in the moment. You're not there. You're allowing yourself, God bless you, to be carried around by something or other. So try and become aware of when you really find yourself drifting away, when you're allowing procrastination to take you to /dot for the millionth time that day. Try and become more aware. Personally, I use kitchen timers. Is it really dorky? Am I basically like Rain Man? You bet. But I never get more than 8 or 10 minutes away from what I need to do, and I'm like, okay, I got to get back to this. You know, like again, to quote Annie Lamott, she said at one point that she liked to adopt this idea of her mind as being like a wayward puppy that she's trying to paper train. You know, if you're trying to paper train a puppy, you don't pick it up and drop kick it every time it takes a leak. You just pick it up and you put it back on the paper. And that's the essence of mindfulness in a nutshell, is every time you start drifting away, put the puppy back on the paper. Turn down the volume, for God's sake, people. You know, there's something about this state that we're in right now where we seem to just crave this huge amount of stimulation all the time. You know, you got to have the Metallica blaring while you're looking at your, you know, 700 RSS feeds and reloading 11 jillion tabs in Firefox. You know, ask yourself, you know, what is it you're keeping up with all the time? You know, and if you've got a good answer for that, more power to you. But more often than not, you're just spinning around these little pinballs in your head. That's just my quick thought on that. When you do decide to do things to improve your productivity or to make incremental changes on your life, choose your changes carefully, choose mindfully, and don't go tearing ass after everything that comes around the corner. Think about Thoreau once said something along the lines of, beware of all enterprises that require new clothes. Absolutely still in effect here, right? Do you really want to go and pretend that you're somebody else and then eventually fall back down to your baseline state? Or are you going to be mindful about how you choose these things? And finally, for the love of God, resist fiddling. Fiddling is one of the biggest problems in getting things done. Fiddling is what we in the business call a known issue. And that's this constant desire to always be tweaking your system. If I just had another 15 days to work on this, I could really get this just perfect. Well, resist fiddling. Change just as much as you need to. My friend Mike Montero has a wonderful, he and Erica Hall have a great company called Mule Design up in San Francisco. They do those great shirts, those Squid Overlord shirts. You should buy one. And I don't know who it was. I suspect it was Mike. Recently coined the term Metro Technical. And Mike defines a Metro Technical as someone who's willing to try any piece of software or hardware for at least a week until the shine wears off and they go sniffing for the next buzz. Ask yourself, friends. Are you a Metro Technical? Do you spend all day reloading Delicious, hoping that there's some new Web 2.0 widget that you'll be able to put in place? What's wrong with what you got, you know? And so finally, I can't leave you without just a few super quick tips for things you might want to do. A lot of these are kinds of things I talk about on 43 Folders all the time. I'm going to toss a few things out. These are pretty atomic. 5 things you can do tomorrow. Number 1, decrease the automatic mail checking time on your email app. If you're checking your email every minute, you're inviting something on the order of over 2,000 interruptions into your life every week. You don't need your email every minute. Mine is set to every hour, and I don't miss very much. If you doubt that this will be a salutary change to your life, go back over your last week of email and figure out exactly how many of them needed a 59-second response. And you might suddenly find that you are burning a lot of cycles on notifications you don't need. So I'm not saying you can do every hour. A lot of you, again, you work in Korean missus silos and you need those kind of updates. But, you know, tomorrow, just for fun, for an hour, try doing it every 15 minutes and no cheating. Jot down one dumb problem. When something starts vexing you tomorrow, just grab, I know you got sticky notes, you people love sticky notes. Grab your sticky notes and jot down a stupid problem. If something's vexing you, take it from being just on the edge of your conscious and put it in front of you and go, you know what, this is something I'm gonna work on. This is a really stupid, dumb thing. I don't care if it's a squeaky bathroom door. If you figure out that your life could be improved just a little bit by oiling a squeaky door, you've just made your life so much better in a way that was completely non-invasive. So think about a dumb problem that you can fix tomorrow. Run a dash. One of my favorite tips on the site. If you have issues with procrastination, consider running what I call a procrastination dash. Procrastination dash suggests that one reason we tend to put things off is because we have this anxiety about starting it. We have this anxiety, this guy Neil Fiore, who wrote this wonderful book called The Now Habit that I highly recommend, says that a lot of the problem is that we need to not be obsessing about finishing. We need to be persistently starting. I mean, not starting from scratch, but we need to be constantly returning, right? So think about this. Let's say you just got married and you got all these stupid thank you notes to write now, right? So instead of saying, oh, geez, I've got 800 thank you notes that I've got to write. You know what? You don't. You've got 3 thank you notes to write. And after you write your 3rd thank you note, you get to quit writing them for a while. But you know what? You got started. And you just might be amazed to find out how easy it is to answer 10 more once you've answered 3. Find something that makes it easy for you to get started on a project you've been putting off tomorrow. It's very empowering. It's going to make you feel great. Another quick idea. I think I picked this up from Ernest Hemingway. Always try to leave a little water in the well. Or put differently, park on a downhill slope. Tomorrow, when you quit work, stop right in the middle of something. Stop right in the middle of something where you're absolutely confident about what you're doing. If you're a writer, stop in the middle of a sentence. If you do stuff with boxes and arrows, stop at one of Jesse's diamonds. And leave yourself a little sticky note that says, I stopped here and here's why. Put it in a folder, you know exactly where to start up the next day. Hugely helpful. You know, don't make yourself invent the wheel every day. And while you're at it, call your mom. Because in all of this running around and all of this tearing ass from one thing to another, it's really easy to lose track of the fact that a lot of this is about connecting with human beings. And if you're spending way too much time reloading /dot and delicious and 43 folders, then you need to get out more. Above all, become untethered and lose your pants. Thank you very much. I would, at this juncture, entertain questions. I know you're tired. Somebody just humor me. Make me earn my Mexican dinner.
Is it conceivable, after a long amount of study of human being and behavior, that there would be a mobile device that's more helpful than hurtful?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, just to be clear, like, I am not by any stretch trying to say, don't use a palm. I'm saying a palm didn't work for me. Well, 2 things. First of all, I think the most important thing is that you choose things mindfully. You know, don't just go out and buy stuff because you saw it on an infomercial. I mean, you guys are smart enough to know that, and yet, you know, people are always chasing the next phone. They're always chasing the next computer. Like, when's the last time a computer was really that much better than the last one that you had? Just saying. But as far as that, your question specifically, hell yeah. I mean, there's a lot that still is going to be exciting stuff that's going to be happening with mobile devices. One thing that's so great about stuff like Chandler is to see stuff coming along. We're not there yet, but it's getting better. You're seeing stuff that seems more about how people use it rather than how programmers want to develop it. And they're starting to think about my silos instead of their silos. And I think that's a salutary step. And getting a way to do that well wirelessly is going to be huge. I mean, there's a lot of money there. So I think you're going to see really interesting stuff.
So you were saying that we evolve slower than our tools. But do you think our tools are actually starting to evolve more quickly because you have more people involved in building technology, which feeds its own?
Right. Yeah. No, probably. Yeah. I mean, there's, what's so funny, because I mean, like, you know, this is the funny thing. So, like, growing up in Florida, you know, I only know what I learned from TV, and I always assumed that products were being advertised to me because they were what I needed, and that they were, and I wasn't a complete idiot, but it's easy to see, looking in from the outside, that these are things that are being designed because they've been tested well and they're going to work excellently. And the truth is, once you're working on the inside, you start seeing how much of this is what they could push out in this release, and how much of it is involved. Think about, like, gosh, my phone is just right now, it's just full of all these business relationships. I've got a business development device, not a communications device. I mean, there's all these ways in which that's out of sync. I mean, I don't know. I don't know enough about the technology or the business relationships to speak intelligently. But you know what? I think they do feed on each other in the same way that the operating systems get more powerful as you get more RAM, and you know, you've got that spiral. I don't know. I guess the thing that I always think about, though, is a really super quick anecdote. When I was in seventh, well, actually, I started in junior high in Florida in eighth grade. But in seventh grade at my junior high, they had this thing called vocational wheel, where you go and you have this series of three-week modules. And this is 1980 in basically semi-rural Florida. And it's like they teach you wood shop, they teach you metal shop, they teach you health occupations. They called it nursing, but personally, I never saw anyone express milk, so I think it was a fraud. And they teach you all of these things that basically prepare you for this blue-collar life in Florida. It's so funny. I guess what I'm getting at is, like, I've said this before, but I wonder what the vocational wheel of the future is going to look like. And what are the kind of skills that we start teaching people that are coming up right now? I mean, obviously, you meet anybody who's younger than me, and they're great at the video games, and they're great at dealing with email. A lot of this stuff, they've just kind of absorbed. But I mean, how many of the skills in your life, how many of you are successful today by accident? Because you were able to cobble together accidentally the skills that have made you successful. Nobody ever taught you how to manage your time. Nobody ever taught you how to say no. You know, nobody ever teaches you how to deal with being overwhelmed by a ridiculously mounting amount of information. So, I mean, I think when we have these conversations with the people who make this stuff, though, I think we need to say, you know what, the BlackBerry is a great idea, but I don't need email while I'm eating.
So I know how you feel about emails, but how do you feel about meetings? And as a follow-up question, do you have any tips for us that live in a meeting-based culture?
Yeah. Well, actually, I have a pretty long post about that on the site I did not too long ago. But so that might have been a softball, and for that I thank you. My feeling on meetings, actually, you can check this out on the site. Just do a Google search on meetings. But yeah, I think absolutely. I think meetings can be, my friend Ethan works at Warner Brothers Music in LA. He calls them vampire meetings, you know, where you go in there and the energy is completely drained because of the, you know. And I shared the anecdote of when I worked at .com up there on Menlo Ave, I would spend the better part of one day a week on a conference call with about two dozen people on two coasts on a video conference call. Of which it was basically two people talking, two C-levels talking to each other over. And then a lot of people making $50,000 to $250,000 a year sitting there, occasionally showing their hand where they'd written kill me. So that the people... So I'm the wrong person to ask, probably. But no, but the truth is meetings can be great. But here's what, okay, so super quick dash on what makes a meeting great. First of all, scheduling. Super tight on when you start, when you end, and when you take email and bio breaks. Close the laptops, turn off the phones. BlackBerries are not even allowed in the room. You're there because other people have had the time and the decency to set aside time for this meeting, and you're not so special that you can't take a couple minutes when they can. Schedule your people for when they're needed during the meeting. Don't have people sit there for 3 hours if they're only going to be needed for the last 10 minutes of it. Have an agenda, stick to it, have a timekeeper. Never be afraid to say, let's move on at this point. Never be afraid to shut off a rat hole by saying, you know what, you two guys should go settle that offline. And I'm sure you can do that. Make it all about decisions that and discussions for whatever's, you know, have the people in the room reflect the decisions that are on the table rather than just turning it into these, you know, meetings where like some C-levels holding court, you know. So anything else?
So in a world with a lot of noise, do you have any hacks for finding clear signals with good music?
Is that an analogy? Or do you actually want to know what music to listen to?
No, metaphorically.
Yeah. No, it's true. We were talking about this just a little bit at dinner, and this idea of what I think what Cory Doctorow has called the reputation economy, and this whole idea that as we get more stuff in the world, it's going to become harder and harder to know, you know, what we should listen to, I mean, or what we should do, or what books we should read. And yeah, I really do. I believe in the idea of finding your own collaborative filters in your world. I had this friend, Catherine Yu. She's like 10 for 10. Everything, I think, yeah, Catherine went to Stanford. She's 10 for 10. Every band she's ever suggested to me has been fantastic. So I trust her implicitly. She hasn't had a loser in the bunch yet. And just in general, I mean, you know, I'll just close with this, I guess. Is there other questions other than this? I'll just close with this. Just that I think there, I mean, I'm not telling you guys anything you don't know, but there's so much noise out there right now, and there's so many demands on your attention. And I mean, if there's anything that I could get out to you kids tonight, it's the idea that you are the single person in the entire universe who can say no when things come into your life, right? And I don't mean to get all motivational speaker on you, but this is actually huge. You know, you're going to get a lot of email tomorrow. And if you start thinking that your default answer to every one of those should be yes, you're going to be in a world of pain. And so I would just encourage you, as you go out and seek these clearer signals and less noise, to also just be aware of the fact that people are going to constantly demand more and more of your time. And that the more that you value your time, the more other people are going to value your time. And if you should not feel like you're being stuck up or unkind when you tell people, that's a great thing, but I just don't have the bandwidth for it right now. And that goes for a lot of the other crap in your life, too. Try deleting a couple things off your TiVo. My God, if I see that same CSI one more time, I think I'm going to completely lose it. You know, maybe try going with just a few fewer Netflix. You know, this is not about overhauling your life and like I say, turning into a, you know, a hippie and playing hacky sack. This is about making really small changes that can actually have outsized benefits to you. And I hope that's useful to you. Visit 43 Folders, and thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for listening. The background music is River from the album Arras by Curandero. The music of Curandero is available for magnatune.com. This program was produced entirely by Baikai volunteers, thanks to program chairs Paul Sass and Rashmi Sinha. G. Kim and I recorded the program. We're extremely grateful to Park for providing the meeting space and the services of our terrific sound engineer, Deanna Horvath. Thank you to all the other Baikai volunteers who serve the Kai community, and, of course, especially to Baikai members for your support. Thank you.